Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In his years as National Security Advisor and Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger was a towering figure in American foreign policy, revered and reviled. His outsized power demanded respect. It also won him fear and loathing. Kissinger's latest book, Crisis, The Anatomy of Two Major Foreign Policy Crises, reveals the intimate inner workings of top-level crisis management in two crises on his watch: the explosive October 1973 war between Israel, Egypt, and Syria, and the sorrowful 1975 American evacuation from Vietnam. Both echo in the crises of today. The war in Iraq has itself become a battle for hearts and minds. The legacy of Kissinger's Vietnam still haunts policymakers as an example of the limits of American might. We caught up with Henry Kissinger earlier today, so regrettably cannot take your call. But you will get the view of Richard Nixon's Machiavelli, looking back and looking out on the current global challenges facing the United States and the world. Tonight on Point, Henry Kissinger and the Anatomy of Crisis. Joining me now is Henry Kissinger. He served as National Security Advisor to both Presidents Nixon and Ford, and as Secretary of State from 1973 to 1977. He is currently Chairman of Kissinger Associates, an international consulting firm. Welcome to On Point, Henry Kissinger.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. An amazing amount of detail and inside conversation that you've conveyed in this new book. There's a lot we want to dig into there. But before we do, just as a matter of context, you're writing here about crisis in 1973 and in 1975. For us, as we listen, do you think, would you say that the United States foreign policy is in crisis right now or not?
I wouldn't say foreign policy is in crisis, but I would say that it is dealing with a number of concurrent crises. But that is almost inseparable from foreign policy when you are a superpower.
So crises, that being in Iraq and...
Well, we have an immediate crisis in Iraq. We have a longer-term, I don't know whether crisis is exactly the right word, but a longer-term challenge of the emergence of countries, immediately China, in a little while India, into the international system. We have a disproportion in the representation on the on the UN Security Council that countries that are no longer fully major powers are represented, but countries like Japan and India and Brazil are not represented. So all of these things are challenges that foreign policy has to deal with.
You've written this new book. It's largely the transcript by your secretaries of telephone conversations during these two crises, one in 1973, the Yom Kippur War, the other 1975, the famous days that all Americans remember or know from images of the last helicopter taking off from the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. New York Times describes it as history seen as the ticker tape flow of urgent conversation, and it is, I must say, almost weirdly compelling as it goes forward. I wonder if you could just tell us how you came to do this now. These transcripts have recently been declassified. How and why did you decide to turn them into a book?
Well, all these transcripts have been made available to the National Archives, all of the transcripts of 8 years of being in office, and they will be released as a group. But I thought it might be interesting to pick out two events that extended only over 1 month, in which it is easier to follow how policy is managed, and two events that were conducted largely on the telephone because of their urgency, and therefore there wasn't enough time to have the usual diplomatic meetings. And so I picked the Middle East War of October 1973 and the final collapse of Indochina in 1975 to show how this appeared from the security advisors and Secretary of State's office, printing practically every conversation, omitting only those that were repetitive.
Tell us then, if you could, with each of these, and if we could start with the October 73 war, from your view then, and looking back on it now, what was at stake in these urgent conversations going between Israel and the U.S., Moscow and the U.S., Cairo and the United States? You were in the middle of this, awakened in the early hours of the war beginning to unfold. As you saw it then, as you see it now, what was at stake?
In the most immediate sense of what was at stake was the survival of an American ally in the state of Israel. In the longer term sense, what was at stake would be the future orientation of the nations of the Middle East towards the United States and towards the international system in general. And this was still in the height of the Cold War. There were Soviet arms all over the place and Soviet advisors in many of these countries. It was about the relative role of the Soviet Union and the United States in the future evolution of the Middle East.
You described the 73 crisis as one in which ultimately American strategic goals were confirmed in the outcome of the crisis. Give us a sense of what those goals were and how the crisis was managed in a fashion, in your view, to assert or confirm those goals.
Well, the American strategic goals were to demonstrate that reliance on the Soviet Union would not advance Arab causes, that they could get Arab arms, but that they needed American diplomacy to achieve their objectives. And this was important not just for the immediate aftermath of the war, but for the future orientation of these countries. Secondly, we sought to turn this crisis into a situation where peace negotiations could start between neighboring Arab states and Israel, and to do it under American auspices so that the process could be managed for the maximum of progress and stability. How we did this was to maintain simultaneously close communications, of course, with Israel, whose survival was challenged, but simultaneously also with the Arab leaders, especially with President Sadat of Egypt, even though Egypt did not maintain diplomatic relations with us at the moment, and also to be in close contact with the Soviet Union so that they would understand what we were doing and so that also we could anticipate their actions and, if necessary, it's worth them.
There's some amazing moments here. In October 20th of that year, you were in Moscow late at night in the Kremlin, dining with Brezhnev. You say there were some bizarre aspects to that meal. While you were dining, each of your countries, these superpowers, were pouring arms into their respective allies in a war that was at a white heat.
Well, the war, it was beginning to break in our favor or in the favor of our ally. Well, there were a number of bizarre aspects to that evening. First one was that I was having dinner with Brezhnev at all because when I arrived in Moscow, they already served me a very heavy meal at the state guest house for the negotiations that were supposed to start the next day. And then around 11:30 at night, the Soviet protocol people came to me and suggested that I have another meal with Brezhnev. And so we went off to the Kremlin. And I, frankly, at that point, since Israel was winning, wanted to gain as much time as possible before negotiations started, because the situation could only improve in our direction. So I kept saying to Brezhnev, I need instructions before I can make final decisions.
You were trying to postpone everything.
I was not trying to postpone the negotiation, but I was trying to postpone the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And then Brezhnev pulled out a piece of paper and said, no, you don't need it. President Nixon has just sent me full authority for you to decide in his name.
So Brezhnev was leaving you no stalling room there.
Left me no stalling room. So then I went back to the state guest house and on an open line called up General Haig, who was chief of staff of Nixon, and raised hell about being given full authority, which was not my usual method. And he said, why don't you get off my back? I have problems of my own. And I said, what problems can you possibly have in Washington on a Saturday night?
Yeah.
And it turned out the night of the Saturday night massacre, which inaugurated the final phase of Watergate.
This is when, of course, Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor, was fired, and Attorney General Elliot Richardson resigned.
Elliot Richardson resigned, and very shortly afterwards, within days, the House started impeachment proceedings against President Nixon.
Did you find, Henry Kissinger, that your hand in negotiating this crisis was strengthened or weakened by the utter distraction, presumably, of President Nixon?
Well, bureaucratic students would say that if the president is distracted, then the Secretary of State has a greater field for initiatives. But in reality, the scope you have for diplomacy depends on the credibility and weight of your leadership. And I considered Watergate an enormous handicap for American diplomacy.
Certainly it was an enormous cloud over all your working at that time. You've watched the Middle East unfold since then over these very many years. Did you ever imagine, you end that crisis on a hopeful note, thinking that the chess pieces are in good position, perhaps for peace. Did you ever imagine?
Well, and it led actually to three agreements within an 18-month period, two
yes.
between Egypt and Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And one between Syria and Israel.
But ultimately, we see
ultimately
where things stand
today. Ultimately, it ran into the sand again.
And why is that?
Well, the conflict in the Middle East involves ethnic and ideological and religious aspects. For many of the Arabs, Israel is an illegitimate state. That is, it took a piece of territory which the Arabs for hundreds of years had considered their own. And particularly the Palestinians find it extremely difficult to accept the legitimacy of the state of Israel. On the other hand, Israel, knowing that this attitude exists and not having been recognized by any of its neighbors practically since its existence, at least by most of its neighbors, feels a need for a level of security that some of the neighbors consider incompatible with their dignity. And so it has been very difficult to find common denominators.
In all this, your reputation is as a hard-headed foreign policy guy focused on interest, not sentimentality. How has the U.S.-Israel alliance redounded to the U.S. interest or not?
First of all, let me explain my position. It is usually, the argument is made that there are some people like myself who are supposed to be realists and they look exclusively at American interests. And then there are others, more idealistic people who look primarily at values. I think the real world is much more complex. If you conduct foreign policy of any country, and certainly if you are responsible for the foreign policy of the United States, you of course have to be aware of American interests, above all the overriding interest of security. But you must also be aware that this is a country that was born out of turning its back on Europe and of believing that America represented very special values in this world. And if you're a refugee, as I have been, from totalitarianism, you've got to be particularly conscious of this. So I have always believed that there is an integral connection between interests and an understanding of your fundamental goals. Now, Israel is a democracy. Israel has been tied to the United States historically since the 40s by a common faith in democracy, and America has asserted that it considers the survival of Israel important to its view of what a just international system is. But that does not mean America needs to endorse every last foreign policy objective of Israel.
Secretary Kissinger, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight with Henry Kissinger, author of the new book, Crisis, the Anatomy of Two Major Foreign Policy Crises. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with former Secretary of State, former National Security Advisor in the administrations of President Nixon and President Bush, Henry Kissinger. His new book is Crisis, the Anatomy of Two Major Foreign Policy Crises, looking there at the 1973 Yom Kippur War in the Middle East and at the 1975 evacuation from Vietnam from Saigon. Henry Kissinger, you write that in the Middle East crisis, policy was designed to shape events in conformity with America's values and national interests. You write, in the last month of U.S. involvement in Indochina, policy was confined to damage limitation. You had helped steer toward that moment, but you are very critical of the U.S. Congress in the final phase of the Vietnam War in all of your writing, and again in your recounting here in your new book.
Well, first of all, by 1975, Vietnam had got totally out of control. In 1973, partly as a result of Watergate, the Congress had passed an act which prohibited American military actions in, over, or and near Vietnam, which paralyzed the enforcement of the agreement. Secondly, it cut
this is
American...
the enforcement of the 1973 peace agreement.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the peace agreement that you don't enforce is just a formula for surrender. Secondly, the aid to Vietnam was cut from $2.5 billion in 1973 to $700 million in 1975, at a moment that oil prices were using up a greater proportion than they had even in the $2.5 billion figure of the costs of supporting Vietnam. So that by 1975, we were no longer steering the Indochina policy. It had been absorbed in the divisions in America. What I was describing was from the executive, branch's point of view, how matters looked in a very tragic period, and America had become so divided that it was no longer possible to conduct a constructive foreign policy on Vietnam and on Indochina. I treat it as a tragedy rather than as an assignment of blame.
There's a transcript of the conversation between you and President Ford, April 29th, a Tuesday, 1975, 7:20 in the evening, you saying to the president, I just wanted to tell you they are down to one helicopter load, to 38, and the helicopters were reported 5 minutes out. And then, no, there are two. Lots of confusion around these events, as in 1973. And President Ford saying, let me know as soon as they are in the air. 7:53 that evening, Washington time, early morning in Saigon. The last helicopter with Marines left the embassy roof there. Henry Kissinger, as you look out on what's happening today in U.S. foreign policy, in Iraq in particular, does Vietnam, the ghost, the shadow, the lessons, whatever individuals may have taken away from that conflict, does it still stalk, does it still shadow American foreign policy?
I think it still stalks American foreign policy in some respects. And, of course, any of us who went through that period, whatever side we were on, would be horrified if the same divisions reappeared, because they would mean that either side of the debate would lose.
What's the shadow that you see today?
Well, the shadow, I think where we are now in Iraq is, we can debate how we got into it and what judgments were made, and I was in general in support of it. But where we are now, we do not have the option of a last helicopter out of Baghdad. That would have catastrophic consequences for the rest of the world and for us, because it would mean that every place where there are Islamic potential terrorist cells, The participants in these cells would feel vastly encouraged and convinced that if the strongest nation of the Western world, which is what they're really attacking, can be driven out, then who can stand up to them? And one has to remember that we have seen in the last 2 years attacks in Bali, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, Spain, the United States, Turkey, Uzbekistan. So we're not dealing with a local phenomenon.
When you say that a last helicopter out of Baghdad would be seen as encouragement by a great and global foe, as you speak those words, do they echo the domino theory at all in your mind, or is this an entirely new dynamic?
The domino theory was somewhat different. It had the aspect that it argued that if the United States' credibility is destroyed by not sticking with its friends, then its other friends in the region might be threatened by the same forces and lose heart. And to some extent, that domino theory turned out to be true. I don't think the upheaval in Iran would have occurred without the collapse in Vietnam. But those were still actions within states and by states to each other. Now we have a unique phenomenon, which is the privatization of security policy, and in which private groups that are based in states but do not represent the states conduct terrorist activities, and that they can operate with relatively small groups, but with enormous effect by working in the on the insides of any advanced country and even of developing countries. It's a new threat that has not yet been effectively dealt with.
In the last day and a half, Americans in the world have seen maimed American bodies hanging from the bridge at Fallujah. Americans once again watch the death count coming back from Iraq. Meanwhile, the briefers in Iraq, the Brigadier General Mark Kimmett said just yesterday, the overall area of operations remains relatively stable. Do you hear the echoes of quagmire? Do you see the potential for quagmire in Iraq?
Look, in Vietnam, one of the problems is that if all the media, which has not yet happened, but if all the media start pursuing these themes obsessively, you can always show something that is shocking. That is the nature of these wars. I remember when I visited Vietnam occasionally, that one is struck by, one reads about all the events that go on in these guerrilla wars. But in fact, most of the time, nothing is going on. And most of the time, it is calm. And then suddenly, there's a violent eruption. Relatively few people get killed, but still they're shocking to the observers. And then it quiets down again. And there is this tendency of people beginning to worry what this new crisis might be. But we do not have any real options except to bring about a modern, progressive government. And the only other option we have, and the one we should exercise, is to bring in other nations to cooperate, at least on the political side of this effort.
Whatever we learned about the media, we also learned in Vietnam that the military and authorities could misrepresent what was happening on the ground, perhaps as well. When you look at what's actually happening in Iraq, what is your level of confidence that with its current approach and its current resources, the United States can be successful in bringing this modern democracy that you say the U.S. must bring to Iraq? Just because we must doesn't mean, I suppose, that we will. How do you see it?
First of all, when you talk about misrepresentation by the military, I think the cases where there are deliberate misrepresentations are negligible. The differences arise when in good faith somebody represents something from a perspective that is not the perspective of the observer. So the military in Iraq are correctly reporting that the number of incidents are down, that most of the time it is quiet. But when you read it that way and then you see bodies hanging over bridges, that is not a consolation for the families of those whose bodies are hanging there or for those who think that their sons and daughters are at risk. So this is a question of perspective.
But not to get caught in the theater from any perspective, how do you think it's actually going?
How do I think it's actually going? I think it is at this moment in an inconclusive period, as it almost has to be, given the complexity of the country. So I think the jury is still out of what the final outcome will be. If there is enough time, but that is the big if, I believe it can be brought to a successful conclusion. Successful in a carefully defined way, not even as a democratic government, but as a government that is more representative than what it replaces, and that has a legal system that extends across the whole country, and that is not a threat to its neighbor and does not harbor terrorists towards the outside world.
And what, as you see it, might determine whether there will be enough time, as you put it? What are the factors?
The factors will be partially the outcome of our election, but the way we conduct the election campaign. Because I think it is important that when we have major national issues like this, that we look at them to the greatest extent possible from a nonpartisan point of view. And that is the degree, therefore, to which we conduct our campaign in a manner so that we can come together afterwards, whoever wins, is of great importance.
Henry Kissinger, when you watch the 9/11 Commission hearings that we've all been paying a lot of attention to in the last few weeks, and of course for a time you had been named as co-chairman of these hearings, what do you think of the testimony of the major actors and the line of critique that's emerged specifically from Richard Clark? How is the Clinton administration coming across here? How in particular is the Bush administration looking?
First of all, I think the 9/11 Commission has done a superb job. It has brought key issues out into the open, and it has permitted a full and fair debate of what these issues are. It is difficult in a hearing, at least in a hearing that is not yet even partially completed, to take into account all the factors that will emerge later as the hearings continue. It seems to me that the key issue in the Clinton administration is this. When they came into office, terrorism was conceived as criminal acts that occurred occasionally in a disjointed manner and that was dealt with by law enforcement methods. As the Clinton administration evolved, it began to realize that they were not individual efforts, but that they were part of a system. And I think they came to this understanding rather clearly, if fairly late in terms of the administration. They did not, however, act on this realization except by sporadic attempts, like one missile attack on Afghanistan and one on Sudan, so that the new administration inherited maybe the inside, but no very specific policies to carry out. The new administration then did what always happens in new administrations, to look at how to define policy over a longer term. So they continued more or less the policies of the Clinton administration, while they were studying a policy that would enable them to tackle the system.
But Richard Cole says that he and others presented them with urgent evidence of the urgency of confronting terrorism. The USS Cole had just been blown open in Yemen in the last months of the Clinton years. Do you think there was an ideological or a strategic reluctance to pick up this challenge, this threat?
Well, we will have to see what the testimony of Dr. Rice is. But what one has to understand is that the Bush administration did not want to do these sporadic moves that had characterized the Clinton administration. But in order to do something more encompassing in Afghanistan, for example, which is the place where it had to be if it was aimed at al-Qaeda, at least three conditions had to be met. The sanctions on Pakistan as a result of its nuclear proliferation had to be removed. The sanctions on Uzbekistan because of its human rights violations had to be modified. And India had to be brought into the discussions because any military operations in that region directly impact on India and, of course, on India-Pakistan relations. Those measures seem to me to have been taken even in the absence of the completion of a full review. And some of the ideas of Mr. Clark, as I understand them, while they were quite correct and while they were implemented, could not be implemented without having taken these other preliminary steps, and were fairly difficult to implement if, in the absence of a provocation, if the new administration had come in and started bombing Afghanistan and without some overarching concept they could put before the American people, would have been an extremely contentious operation.
But the Department of Justice didn't include terrorism in its top priorities under John Ashcroft. Richard Clark says that the whole conversation around terrorism frittered out, went away.
I'm not on this program as a defender of every measure that was taken. I would say it's a general proposition that one conclusion that one should draw from this this episode is that in changes of administration, and almost a very complicated hiatus develops, because when you talk about Dr. Reitz doing this or Dr. Reitz doing that, when the new administration comes in, and this happened when I was in that position, it always happens. There are no files in the White House at all. The files of the outgoing president go to his library. And so you have to spend some weeks reconstituting your memory. You are also at that moment deluged by memoranda from every department claiming a high degree of urgency for their programs. And all of this happens while your own people are not yet in place. It takes... Now, with the new security procedures, it takes about 6 months before somebody is cleared sufficiently. So there is a hiatus in changes of administration. And I would like to see, maybe not as a part of that 9/11 report, but as a general proposition for government as a whole, not for this particular transition, to have some attention paid to the question of how does one deal with genuine emergencies in a period when everything militates against it.
Secretary Kissinger, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight with Henry Kissinger, author of the new book, Crisis, the Anatomy of Two Major Foreign Policy Crises. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Henry Kissinger, former National Security Advisor and Secretary of State. His new book is Crisis. Henry Kissinger, you describe particularly in the negotiations over the October War in 1973, Israel very suddenly at war with Egypt and Syria, kind of high-speed, high-stakes chess game of diplomacy that you were in the midst of. When you look at the current administration, is the Bush team playing that game, that diplomatic game, or has it sort of turned over the chessboard and walked away?
Well, first of all, it's a totally different world. To answer your direct question, I don't think that the Bush team has turned over the board and walked away. But they are playing a different. They have to play a different game than we did. We played essentially in a two-power world, and chess is a game for two parties. So we had this criterion and this framework. Within that, then, there were various other players that had to be fitted in, and that had some complexity. The Bush administration lives in a world in which the there is no general agreement on what constitutes the overriding threat, although that is beginning to emerge more and more clearly as the attacks multiply around the world. And so I think it's very hard to compare what the Bush administration does with what we did in the period that I had the opportunity to conduct policy.
And yet there are still powers, there are still allies, there are still the weave of interests and perspectives that you were negotiating in 1973. Given that the situation's changed, as a diplomat yourself of some note, how do you read this administration's commitment to diplomacy as opposed to power projection by the military, let's say?
In the administration, there are points of view that hold that the United States is so powerful that allies can be useful on technical matters, but they're not needed on security matters. And secondly, that there is no single overriding threat. If you take the foreign policy of the administration as a whole and not segment it into what particular element of it think, I think it is generally recognized, and it's becoming increasingly recognized, that power by itself, if you don't want to exercise it every minute of the day, must be buttressed by some concept of legitimacy and therefore requires the assent of other nations. And my impression is that the administration is very definitely moving in that direction, and were President Bush to get a second term, I think this would be one of the themes of his administration.
How would you judge this administration on husbanding that credibility in its first administration, its first term? You know, of course, the criticism. You've seen the polls, like we all have, of U.S. standing globally at historically low levels.
But it's a mistake to put the blame for that entirely or even largely on the United States. You take for example, the Kyoto Protocols, which are often mentioned as an example of American high-handedness. And it is true that President Bush, when coming into office, rejected that environmental agreement called the Kyoto Protocol.
Right, also, out of the box.
That's true. But it's also true that that agreement was negotiated in 1997, that the Senate of the United States had given an opinion by 95-0 against it, and that the Clinton administration had not put it forward for ratification over a three-year period. So what President Bush was rejecting was not something that would have happened but for his rejection. You can argue, and I would argue, that there were more elegant ways of turning it down than we did, and that one could have invited a negotiation to fix points that one was dissatisfied with. But fundamentally, what President Bush was rejecting was an agreement that, A, nobody's implementing, or was implementing at the time, and secondly, that didn't have the slightest chance of getting ratified by the American Senate, as the Senate had made clear by a vote of 95-0.
Well, we see that perhaps with the Kyoto Protocol, but on a from a broader perspective, did the hole that the United States seems to find itself in now with global standing and credibility need to be as deep as it appears to be?
Well, again, one has to do it by region. I think our relations in Europe brought up resulted from a confluence of a conservative direction in this country and an emergence of a new generation in Europe that was sort of sublimating its previous Marxism in a certain kind of pacifism. And the conjunction of those two events created some probably avoidable tensions. On the other hand, if you look at the relations with China, Russia, India, countries that are going to be major players and are major players today, it would not be correct to say that the United States is in particular difficulties. And it isn't true in every European country. It is true in Germany and France. It is not true in Eastern Europe, and it is less true in other countries.
You're a student of grand strategy. When you look at these first 3.5 years of the Bush administration, how would you describe this administration's effective worldview, its grand strategy?
Well, almost every administration that I have seen, and that was true also of the administration in which I served, needs some years in which to evolve a clear definition of its strategy and of an assessment of where it finds itself. I would think that the view of the administration is that the United States has tremendous power, which confers on it also a special responsibility, but also that the United States has almost an obligation to help foster the spread of democracy in other countries of the world, an obligation which it exercises in bringing pressure in various situations, and sometimes even uses military means to foster when there are other reasons to do it as well. So this is a sweeping approach of the American role, which is still, in terms of the way one looks at history, in its early phases.
That is, pushing for democracy with American might, with American armed might, that military?
I believe that Iraq, in this case, was a very special situation. The mere fact that a country is non-democratic unless it engages in violations of human rights of a scale that is not very visible today would not trigger American military intervention. But when it is put together with the proliferation of nuclear weapons and the consistent disregard of United Nations resolutions and the location in the midst of a region from which terrorists descended on the United States, then you have a different kind of situation. But it has not yet been formalized. And I, in my capacity as professor, have often argued that I agree that the principle of preemption has to operate in the current situation that has these elements of terrorism and proliferation. But I also believe that it cannot be left to one nation alone, and that some international effort should at least be attempted to define under what circumstances preemption is appropriate and in what it is not.
You are very familiar with any number of the players in the Bush administration, reading accounts of the end of the Vietnam War, the evacuation there. You're on the phone with Donald Rumsfeld, who was White House Chief of Staff for President Ford then. Where do you see, just to take Donald Rumsfeld, now Secretary of Defense, where do you see his imprint, his fingerprints on current U.S. Foreign policy?
Well, actually, Donald Rumsfeld, my relationship with Donald Rumsfeld has evolved which in retrospect is a very surprising way. In 1975, when we were part of the administration together, he and I were on opposite sides, and I recognized him as a formidable figure, but also as an opponent of many of the things that I was trying to get accomplished. But at that time, he was also thinking of himself as a potential presidential candidate in the decades ahead. Now he has no further ambitions, and now he can concentrate on doing what the right thing is at the moment. In that capacity, he is a powerful, extremely intelligent, very decisive leader who has represented the point of view that his duties impel him to, and I think he's done it in an extremely effective manner.
Henry Kissinger, the French lawyer Jacques Verger, who has volunteered to defend Saddam Hussein in Iraq, said on Sunday that if he should ultimately defend the former Iraqi leader, dictator, that he would call on Donald Rumsfeld and yourself to testify at that former Iraqi leader's trial. Do you see grounds for that, and would you be prepared to testify in such a trial?
I can't conceive what I have to contribute that is relevant to Saddam's actions, all of which occurred in a period in which I was not in office. So if I'm asked questions by an international tribunal, I would certainly do my best to respond to them. But to me, that looked like a publicity stunt, at least as far as I was concerned.
And what about your personal life these days, Henry Kissinger? You have your admirers, and of course you have people who deeply loathe your record in foreign policy. Are you able to travel freely globally?
I travel freely. I travel globally. And I think there is a group of people that are carrying some of their policy disputes into personal vendettas, but they have not succeeded in interrupting my life. But they're, of course, entitled to their views.
You write in Crisis that the gods are offended by hubris. And, of course, there you're talking in particular about just a moment in one negotiation. But when you look back on your long and storied career, where would you point to hubris in your own actions? We all have them.
Look, there are moments when you think you have accomplished something that is permanent, that turns out to be very transitory. When we received the North Vietnamese proposal, which we considered a breakthrough in the negotiations and an achievement of what we had tried to bring about, all my colleagues and I were congratulating each other, and we were deeply moved. And it turned out that what we thought was a more permanent thing was fairly transitory. So these moments occur. On the other hand, anyone who has an opportunity to engage in public service should know that there's nothing more important he can do, and he should also approach public service with the attitude that it is a service that is in which hopefully he leaves things better than he found them.
Henry Kissinger, thank you for joining us. Henry Kissinger, author of Crisis, the Anatomy of Two Major Foreign Policy Crises. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Jane Manners and Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.